watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Tonight's program will feature another edition of The Wizards of Money, which will focus on predatory lending practices and how they target and despoil the meager assets of low-income seniors. First, though, some excerpts from a local teach-in on W's New War, and how predatory religious fanaticism and racism have played and are playing a role in the latest chapter of the battle for control of the world's resources.
From the widows and orphans, never hard-working man.
The roots of the September 11th bombings go back to the Cold War, where any ally, no matter how repulsive, repressive, or fanatic, was eagerly embraced by the capitalist powers so long as it fit into their geopolitical schemes. The British foreign correspondent Robert Fisk recalled the following incident in a recent article, quote, "I was working for the Times in 1980, and just south of Kabul I picked up a very disturbing story. A group of religious Mujahideen fighters had attacked a school because the communist regime had forced girls to be educated alongside boys. So they had bombed the school, murdered the head teacher's wife, and cut off her husband's head. It was all true. But when the Times ran the story, the Foreign Office complained to the Foreign Desk that my report gave support to the Russians. Of course, because the Afghan fighters were the good guys. Because Osama bin Laden was a good guy. Charles Douglas Home, then editor of the Times, would always insist that Afghan guerrillas were called freedom fighters in the headline. Here, by comparison, are the words of that beacon of American moral rectitude, Reverend Jerry Falwell, spoken during an interview with Pat Robertson on the Christian Broadcasting Network's 700 Club a few days after the suicide plane attacks.
The ACLU's got to take a lot of blame for this.
Oh, yeah.
And I know I'll hear from them for this, but throwing God, or successfully with the help of the federal court system, throwing God out of the public square, out of the schools. The abortionists have got to bear some burden for this, because God will not be mocked. And when we destroy 40 million little innocent babies, we make God mad. I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the thing in their face and say, you helped this happen.
And that was the Reverend Jerry Falwell speaking with Pat Robertson on the Christian Broadcasting Network shortly after the suicide plane attacks. The September 11th bombings and resulting media-fueled war fever has brought to the surface the deep roots of American racism. Last week, a Native American woman walking on a road in Oklahoma was beaten almost to death by a gang of thugs who screamed at her to go back to where she came from. Murderous attacks are taking place all over the country against dark-skinned people of Middle Eastern and non-Middle Eastern descent. The rallying cry of God and country is heard everywhere. Anti-racist author and educator Tim Wise takes a look at the ugliness of American bigotry that is fueling the flag-waving.
Enemies Both Foreign and Domestic, The Limits of Revenge and Rhetoric by Tim Wise. Well, it looks as if the good people of the rural U.S. should be breathing a sigh of relief right about now. After all, with the president and most Americans itching to bomb any place where terrorists might be hiding, one can only imagine the kind of wrath that would have been brought down upon the heads of folks in Iowa, Nebraska, Wyoming, or Mississippi had the guilty parties been white boys with crew cuts like Tim McVeigh. all this talk of, quote, kill the Arabs, unquote, quote, carpet bomb them back into the Stone Age, unquote, or, quote, get the ragheads, unquote, would have to have been replaced with kill the crackers, bomb them back to the Dust Bowl, and get the trailer trash. But the fact is, we all know that such a scenario would never have transpired, and not because white boys aren't capable of inflicting mass death. They certainly are. McVeigh proved that, if for some folks, Hitler, Stalin, Andrew Jackson, Lyndon Johnson, and Dick Nixon weren't sufficient to make the case. But rather, because the folks who are so quick to collectivize the responsibility and the payback when the perps are dark-skinned or, quote, foreign, unquote, are just as quick not to do so when white boys are the ones committing mass murder or engaging in terroristic activities. In the wake of Oklahoma City, none of the people who are now calling for war against Afghanistan even suggested targeting white supremacist groups and militias for destruction, let alone bombing the cornfields of Middle America in the hopes of taking out a few anti-government types. Bottom line, enemies who look different, speak a different language, or practice a different religion are lots easier to view as the, quote, other, unquote, as somehow cut off from the common humanity of which we consider ourselves a part, and so we speak now of killing Arabs indiscriminately, of not differentiating between the guilty and the innocent, ironically the precise mentality of whoever carried out last week's attacks, and winning a war, which we claim has been officially engaged. But we would have said none of these things had the perpetrators been internal extremists. We said none of these things about those who fit the descriptions of Tim McVeigh or Terry Nichols. We would never have heard columnists calling for profiling of white men, the way the reactionary crank and wannabe pinup girl of the right, Ann Coulter, called for the same against Arabs and Muslims last week. Actually, that wasn't all she said. She also opined that it should be the role of the United States to invade, quote, their, unquote, countries, kill, quote, their, unquote, leaders, and, quote, convert them to Christianity, unquote. If these were the words of an imam calling for the forced conversion of Southern Baptists to Islam, we would call them the fanatical ramblings of a jihad-happy madman. But when the fashion-conscious and attractive, though clearly Snickers-deprived, Coulter says it, she finds mass support for her nuttiness, gets her call for a new round of crusades published on the website of the National Review, and will remain a regular commentator for such paragons of journalistic virtue as Fox News. So too Jerry Falwell, who, for some unknown reason, people still take seriously despite his penchant for committing random acts of serial stupidity. His latest? Laying the blame for the attacks on New York and D.C. at the feet of the ACLU for throwing God out of the schools, the abortionists because God will not be mocked, and as well as pagans, feminists, and the gays and lesbians. After offering this truly maniacal glob of pedantic crap, Falwell's partner in fundamentalist lunacy, Pat Robertson, chimed in to blame, quote, pornography on the internet, unquote, abortion and the removal of the Ten Commandments from the courthouses. God, according to these twin towers of intellectual mendacity and biblically bankrupt spirituality, is, quote, lifting his protection from us, unquote, as our comeuppance for secular humanism. It makes me think back to what Barry Goldwater said about Falwell in 1981 when the rotund little preacher asked all, quote, good Americans, unquote, to rise up in opposition to the nomination of Sandra Day O'Connor to the Supreme Court, since, after all, the court was no place for a lady. All good Americans, Goldwater intoned, should rise up and give Jerry Falwell a kick in the ass. Precisely. And now 2 decades overdue. Funny how all the discussion of religious fanaticism among certain followers of Islam has led us to overlook the fanaticism of certain Christians who are now calling for blood. One has to imagine that if Jesus was here today, they would call him a pussy for all that turn-the-other-cheek stuff. And while I can't answer the question that so many self-proclaimed followers of Christ ask when they wear their "What Would Jesus Do?" armbands, I feel pretty confident that I know what he wouldn't do. He wouldn't be saying things like, quote, let's shove a couple dozen cruise missiles up their ass, unquote, or going out and spray painting, quote, fuck Islam, unquote, on the mosques, or screaming about the, quote, sand niggers, unquote, while guzzling beer at some sports bar. And for that matter, he wouldn't be standing around chanting USA, USA at a memorial service in an attempt to turn it into a jingoistic pep rally. The events of the past week have brought out the best in people and the worst. On the one hand, the rescue workers diligently seeking for any signs of life amidst perhaps a million tons of rubble. Yet on the other, the cacophony of voices calling for revenge. Oh, sure, they insist it isn't about that, but rather, quote, justice, unquote. They insist that they want more than merely the continued spilling of blood, and that striking back has more purpose than merely proving how tough we are. But ask them what that purpose is and how they think massive military retaliation can actually make us more safe, to say nothing of the safety of others the world over, and their faces go blank or become contorted with anger as they shout, well, we have to do something. We can't just sit here and let them get away with it. But, quote, doing something, unquote, is not a valid pretext for unleashing war. And justice requires that we carefully consider the difference between responsible parties and innocent ones. Just as one would not think it just to level an entire neighborhood in search of one serial killer who might be living in the area, so too is it unjust to speak of turning much of the Arab world into a parking lot in search of the few persons actually behind the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Not only would such a disproportionate response be morally suspect, it would be irresponsible from a security perspective as well. It would leave us all less safe as millions more in the Arab world came to see the U.S. as a bully, unconcerned about innocent lives, Muslim holy sites, or world peace. And 10 years hence, or maybe less, they would understandably retaliate in kind. What is most ironic about all this is that such a scenario, the West and Islam locked in mortal combat, is exactly what the Osama bin Ladens of the world have always wanted. It is a trap rejected by the vast majority of Arabs and of Muslims wherever they may be, but one in which they too will be caught up if we take the bait. It's really quite simple. We couldn't kill all of, quote, them, unquote, even if doing so is ethically acceptable, which of course it isn't. And those who don't die, who would look around and see their nations leveled, their houses gone, their family members incinerated, would at that point most certainly feel that they had nothing to lose by getting even. And there is no more dangerous member of any society than the one who thinks he has nothing to lose. Desperation doesn't make for very sound judgment. Whether the desperation of the immiserated in the so-called third world or that of the most powerful and yet often least original people on the planet. And so what does that leave us with? The fact is, I don't know, and neither do you, and why we can't just say that, admit our frailties and uncertainties and ignorance, is beyond me. That we demand quick and easy answers is indicative of our cultural attachment to instant gratification. Got a headache? Take an aspirin. Overweight? Get liposuction. Upset about something? Take Prozac. Don't think, don't analyze, just do it. It is Nike's slogan as national mantra. And it is the prelude to international slaughter. No wonder so much of the world looks at America with contempt and at Americans as spoiled children. First, we train terrorists the world over, including bin Laden, because we had to, quote, get the commies, unquote, at all costs, even if it meant supporting dictators, fundamentalists, and murderers. Then we support corrupt and brutal regimes that trample the rights of their citizens. Then we fund and support an illegal occupation of Palestinian land and contribute to the deaths of a million more in Iraq from bombing and sanctions. Then we exhibit our arrogance by withdrawing from international treaties and forums when the going gets tough or issues get raised that we don't want to discuss. This is not to say that any of these things, no matter how irresponsible or even criminal, warrant an act the likes of what we saw September 11th. But there is something to be said for understanding why no one likes you. If all the other kids in the sandbox think you're a thug and a bully, then after a while you'd best stop trying to beat them all into submission or thinking that they are the problem and instead begin to turn some of that analysis inward. That's what you would do anyway if you wanted to actually get to the bottom of the conflict on the playground. If, on the other hand, your main concern were showing what a badass you were, then maybe this wouldn't matter much to you at all. And in that case, you would set out to show those other kids who was boss, who was king of the hill. You would continue to provoke them, to attack them, and then act shock when they hit back. That kind of behavior is unbecoming enough when children engage in it. When adults with explosives do it, the immature becomes deadly. This is no game. There is no winner, despite the blustery rhetoric of our frat boy in chief. Unless we begin to fundamentally alter the way we as a nation operate around the world, we are in for many years of violence and counter-violence and empty platitudes and flag-waving and body bags. And if that happens, it won't merely be the fault of those who attack us from the outside, but also the fault of those who are the enemies of justice, equality, and peace on the inside of the American empire. There will be more than enough blame to go around.
That was The Limits of Revenge and Rhetoric by Tim Wise. In our community as elsewhere, voices in opposition to what the media has termed America's new war are striving to be heard and getting little coverage. Next, two presentations from public gatherings in Ithaca last week that examined the alternatives to war. The first is from a community forum, No More Victims, that took place on September 23rd.
Our first speaker is Professor Ozma Barlas. She's a professor of political science at Ithaca College, and she is a native of Pakistan. We welcome Ozma Barlas. My talk is called Why Do They Hate Us? And it's about 12 minutes long. Several years ago, many of us came together right here to talk about the possibility of another war. And several years ago, I stood right here and read a piece called Should the U.S. Go to War with Iraq? I find it not just ironic, but deeply upsetting that today, from that same spot, I will be asking if the U.S. should go to war, this time with large segments of what we misleadingly call the Muslim world. I say misleadingly because Muslims live in the same world as everybody else. And just like other religious groups, the world's 1 billion Muslims belong to different races, cultures, and ethnicities, not to say differing religious and political persuasions. And yet, there is a tendency to think of us as one homogeneous whole, which then leads so many people to regard the actions of 20 men as somehow constituting a Muslim response to the United States. The fact is that the vast majority of Muslims has condemned the actions of these 20 men. I think the expectation is that I will talk about U.S.-Muslim relations so as to provide some context for understanding the attacks of September 11th and the proposed U.S. response to them. The U.S. has had more than half a century of close encounters with Muslim countries. And Jews, Christians, and Muslims have known each other for some 1,400 years. If in all this time we haven't learned anything about each other, I doubt that a 10-minute history lesson from me will suffice. Still, I want to make some general points about U.S. relationships with not only Muslim countries, but the world at large. In the Sunday, August 19th edition of the New York Times, there is an article by Tim Weiner, Making the Rules in the World Between War and Peace, that begins with the following quote. We are facing an implacable enemy. There are no rules in such a game. Hitherto acceptable norms of human conduct do not apply. We must destroy our enemies by more clever, more sophisticated, and more effective methods than those used against us. And U.S. citizens must learn to understand and support this fundamentally repugnant philosophy. The year, says Weiner, was 1954, and this was a top secret memorandum prepared by the CIA for President Dwight D. Eisenhower. I will let you draw your own conclusions about what it is that differentiates us from our enemies if we believe that acceptable norms of human conduct do not apply in our dealings with others. Or why, in the face of such a view of others, they should not come to hate us. Let me refer to an even earlier secret memorandum written in 1941 by the Council on Foreign Relations in the beginning stages of World War II. This memorandum noted that the U.S. economy, quote, is geared to the export of certain manufactured and agricultural products and the import of numerous raw materials and foodstuffs. In order to avoid possible stresses and major readjustments to the system, the U.S. would need to establish control over a grand area once the war ended. This grand area, in the words of Ellis Stavrianis, consisted of virtually the entire world outside German-dominated Europe, and in particular the Middle East with its rich oil resources. Even if we did not have any examples of how U.S. policies have played out in practice, these two documents are enough in themselves to tell us, A, what it is that the U.S. wants, control over the world, and B, how it intends to go about getting what it wants, by any means necessary. Wanting control over the world is nothing new. As we know, all empires have had it as their goal. It's not even unusual to have as the philosophical basis of one's policy the idea that the ends justifies the means, a dictum we have been taught to associate only with our enemies. What is perhaps new is that the West and the United States still want to be loved as they go about the business of making the world subservient to themselves by any means necessary. For how else can one explain the plaintive question asked endlessly, why do they hate us? There are many competing accounts of why they hate us. The establishment one, of course, is because they are jealous of us and the freedoms we enjoy. But if you're interested in some real reasons, look at the list that Stephen Shalom has put together in Z Magazine, which runs into several pages, and which he says actually minimizes the grievances against the U.S. and the Middle East because it excludes more generalized, long-standing policies. As Stephen Zunes also reminds us, and this is in a piece called U.S. Policy Towards Political Islam on alternet.org, the U.S. is increasingly identified with the political, social, and economic forces that are responsible for the misery of the oppressed, underrepresented, and poor segments of the population who experience not individual liberty, the rule of law, and economic prosperity, but the worst traits of American culture, including materialism, militarism, and racism. Putting things into a historical perspective, Zunes speaks of Western hostility to Muslims dating from the time of the Crusades, which is why President Bush's use of this word today can hardly be considered innocuous. Of course, whether or not it is a judicious use, I leave it to you to decide, given that the Crusades, after all, failed. As a professor of medieval studies has just pointed out, Zunes also refers to the ongoing bombing and sanctions against Iraq, U.S. support for Israeli brutalities against the Palestinians, its overthrow of moderate regimes from Iran to the Sudan, and its support of dictators, hardliners, and extremists, all of whom oppress their own people. And then we have the gall to ask, why do they hate us? This is not only a naive and ultimately dishonest question, but having asked it, we also answer it ourselves, and also dishonestly, because we ignore the reasons that many people give for why they oppose the United States. Quite simply, people everywhere are sick and tired of being lifers in the prison of a global political economy based in the systematic abuse, exploitation, expropriation, and degradation. Let me be clear. I'm not blaming only the United States for all the ills of the world, nor am I condoning terrorism. As Michael Albert and Stephen Shalom point out, quote, The reason it is relevant to bring up U.S. crimes is not to justify terrorism, but to understand the terrain that breeds terrorism and terrorists. Part of that process of understanding entails being able to ask the tough, hard questions that our policymakers are avoiding asking. Consider, for instance, the questions that President Bush raised the other day in his address. He said, "Who attacked our country?" And his answer is that radical and extremist Muslims did. Initially, of course, we heard that it was just a small group, a small gang of extremists under the leadership of bin Laden. And now we hear that there are untold number of terrorist cells in over 60 countries. Mr. Bush is right, of course. However, as Chomsky recently noted, it is not just a question of fundamentalists versus moderates, since even moderate Muslims share bin Laden's, and here I'm going to quote Chomsky, resentment of the U.S. policies of supporting Israeli crimes and blocking the international consensus on a diplomatic settlement for many years, while devastating Iraqi civilian society, supporting harsh and repressive anti-democratic regimes throughout the region, and imposing barriers against economic development by propping up oppressive regimes. Hence, it is not the case that killing off the extremists will resolve all our problems. Also, while the United States talks of extremists and fundamentalists as the enemy, we are allies with some radical and fundamentalist regimes ourselves, cases in point being Saudi Arabia, and even the Taliban before September 11th, to whom the U.S. government gave $43 million in aid. Now we are being told this is a fundamentalist government that oppresses its own people and that we need to wipe it out in order to save civilization. If one wants a list of enemies, the list is a long one. Since I first came to the United States in 1983, the U.S. has, and here I'm quoting from Peter Keller, bombed, invaded, supported the overthrow of the government, or supplied arms to one side in a war, Palestine, Iraq, Macedonia, Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Sudan, Lebanon, Libya, Grenada, Panama, and we can add China to this list since the U.S. accidentally bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. And then Mr. Bush innocently asks, why do they hate us? This is at best a disingenuous question, and I believe that the reason we ask it is so that we don't have to ask the question we really should be asking. Why do we hate and oppress them? By always posing the question of one as one of our being hated, we absolve ourselves of the responsibility of having to answer for our oppression of millions of people around the world. Not only that, but by framing the question in this way, we put the onus of loving us on those whom we oppress. Mr. Bush goes on to say, Americans are asking, how will we fight and win this war? His answer is, this is the world's fight. This is civilization's fight. This is the fight of all who believe in progress and pluralism, tolerance and freedom. Of course, this does not tell us how we will fight and win the war. It merely tells us that this is the world's fight. However, make no mistake about it. As Robert Fisk says, this is not the world's fight or for the world's freedom. Quote, no, it is our democracy and our liberty and freedom that Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair are talking about. Our Western sanctuary that is under attack, not the vast place of terror and injustice that the Middle East has become. The problem, of course, lies right here, in our insolent assumption that we can remain pristinely safe in a world of terror and injustice that our own policies have helped to create. As Mr. Bush said, Americans have known wars, but for the past 136 years, they have been wars on foreign soil, except for one Sunday in 1941. Of all the things he said, and God knows he said plenty to frighten and mystify us, this should give us the most pause of all. What kind of hubris, of arrogance, has induced us to believe that we have the right to do things on other people's soil for 136 years that we won't tolerate on our own. If this is supposed to show love for our country, then Benjamin Franklin was right when he said that patriotism was the last refuge of scoundrels. Mr. Bush asked, "Americans are asking what is expected of us." He replies by saying that we should expect to get ready for a long, drawn-out war, unlike any other war we've known before. A half century ago, U.S. policymakers went out in the world, recovering from the throes of World War II, armed with the belief that the new enemy was implacable, that acceptable norms of human conduct did not apply to it, that it had to be destroyed more effectively than it could destroy us, and that U.S. citizens would have to learn to embrace this fundamentally repugnant philosophy. Once before, U.S. citizens were asked to embrace a morally repugnant philosophy they had no role in creating, but whose price they have had to pay today. For surely we have created the enemy we once merely defined and imagined. I think we should expect a bit more of us than preparing to repeat the same mistakes. We can begin by recognizing that patriotism does not equal war always. To love one's country can also mean believing in the possibility that one can make it better. Security cannot always be defined in military terms, and military victories don't always bring peace and safety. If they did, how could we explain the attacks on the U.S. today? The enemy is not always the outsider. Consider Timothy McVeigh. And while the enemy is the terrorist, not every country in which terrorists live is our enemy. Otherwise, how would we define the U.S. where terrorists live in our midst, unbeknownst to us today? We cannot destroy the world in the name of civilization. And finally, others can only respect our humanity to the extent that we respect our own and that of others. I will stop here because the list is a long one, and I'm sure you have much to add to it. Thank you.
A rally was also held on September 20th as part of a nationwide day of action on campuses. The next speaker is Professor Tarawa from the Near Middle East Studies Department at Cornell University, and he addressed the role of academia in issues of war and peace.
As many of you know, I don't prepare anything. I just received an email, and I'm going to speak a little bit about it. Let me start with a categoric statement, which is that in my lone, well, not lone because you're all here, but in my opinion, nonviolent solutions have to be the answer. There is no virtue in the language of violence. I would also say, which is what I've said before, that I'm not naive enough to think that violence isn't going to be part of the answer. I'm not saying I support that. I'm just saying that I recognize that this may be on the horizon. In fact, it may already be happening. But I'd like to speak about peace in another forum, not the forum of the battlefield, over which I have very little control, I regret to say, but the academy. This email is a text written by Michael Radu, senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia, which, quote, specializes in the study of revolutionary and terrorist groups worldwide. And as I read this, I thought, even though I'm uneasy with the fact that the language of violence forms part of, or maybe has to form part of, the rhetoric of heads of state, especially heads of state who've been empowered by their Congress with sweeping powers as commanders-in-chief, I am unwilling to accept that academics speak the language of violence. I'm going to read you part of this. It's a 10-point thing. Point one, this is not a war between the West and Islam, but between the West and a large segment of the Islamic world, which he then calls the fundamentalist minority, but he's already called it a large segment of the Islamic world. For the fundamentalist, the problem is not U.S. policy toward Israel, the Gulf, or anywhere else. The problem is the United States itself, not what we do, but who we are. Let me cut to the chase. Point 7. Legislation has to be dramatically changed in Washington, as well as Ottawa, Brussels, Strasbourg, and all the EU member states. If this war is to be won, obviously he's speaking the language of war and the language of violence. If this war is to be won, the European obsession with American death penalty legislation has to give way to higher priorities, such as extraditing or putting down terrorists for good. I take it putting down means executing. The politically correct campaign in Europe and the United States against racial profiling has to stop. And I'm actually going to stop with this sentiment because I want it to sink in. After all, looking for tall, blonde, and blue-eyed persons in order to stop Middle Eastern terrorism makes no sense. This is what an academic at a foreign policy research institute has to say. It seems to me that our responsibility as citizens of this country, this planet, but especially as people attached to an institution of higher learning and institutions that are founded on certain notions of freedom and responsibility, have a responsibility also not simply to write petitions to our governments and to our leaders, which I'm sure we're all doing, but also to counter this kind of drivel and this kind of incendiary language. This was forwarded to me by a colleague whom I think attaches himself to this kind of thinking. So the peace movement, maybe that's too cynical a term, but the people who are calling for peace, which is everyone here, myself included, have to realize that we not only have to resist the urge for military violence, but we have to resist the urge to give these sorts of people a platform on which not only to speak, but from which to rally people in a kind of, call it support, of any kind of violent response, military or otherwise. I don't have anything more to say. I'd like to warn you away from a lot of the stuff that is on the emails, and I'd like to send you to another piece. Susan Sontag wrote a column. It's a column long in The New Yorker. I'd urge everyone here to read that and to ponder what intellectuals and academics do have to say, because, as you probably all know, we have tremendous power and tremendous institutions behind us, institutions that will outlast any conflict. And I only hope that you're all there, whether it's Washington or whether it's the newspapers or whether it's countering these kind of people when push comes to shove, because push will come to shove.
That was Professor Tarawa from the Near Middle East Studies Department at Cornell University. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva and WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. For the remainder of the program, we bring you the third edition of The Wizards of Money with Smithy. Smithy works as an actuarial consultant in the finance industry and has degrees in mathematics and economics. As a result of hearing the radio program Democracy Now! On her community station, she began to question the anti-democratic nature of the monetary system, whose workings are little understood by most of us.
We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. We hear he is a wizard of a wiz, if ever a wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz is one. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is The Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series, but with a twist. My name is Smithy, and I'm from the land of Oz. In this, the third edition of Wizards, we're going to take a look at how banks bet that poverty will pay off for them. We'll be taking a close look at predatory lending, whereby banks seeking high returns prey on the poor, who, as noted in past editions of Wizards, have little to no voice in the financial system. We will also look at banks' appetites for homes through this predatory lending, followed by the foreclosure process. In this investigation of banks' activities in low-income neighborhoods, it will be most appropriate to look at the relationship between the father of the banks, the Federal Reserve, and the poor. But before exploring this relationship between powerful creditors or money creators and low-income people, let's first review some important points learned from earlier editions of Wizards. We recall that money is created, out of thin air, by the banks and the Federal Reserve System, and is not backed by anything at all but our trust in the monetary system. We also recall from Wizards Part 2 that in the absence of anything real actually backing money, the US dollar is the backbone of the international monetary system. This trust in the US dollar is little more than a group psychological phenomenon that could collapse simply by people starting to question the faith they have in it. But because people don't stop to think about it too much, the above realization can initially cause some shock and confusion, but maybe also some hope. To get more comfortable with this very different way of looking at money and to get a better understanding of the trickery and sleights of hand at work, there is an excellent text which was written way back in 1965 that you should be aware of. It is called A Primer on Money, Banking and Gold, and I would highly recommend this to those who wish for a more detailed technical understanding of the mechanics that were described at a bit of a big picture level throughout Wizards Part 1, which was on how money is created. This book was written by a Mr. Peter Bernstein all those years ago when the monetary system was still bound to the gold standard and so was actually a bit different than it is today. Nevertheless, Mr. Bernstein, who had a long and distinguished career in the banking industry, including many years at the Federal Reserve as a researcher, wrote the best text I have ever seen on this subject. And even though the monetary system has lost its gold backing and several other key changes have been made, much of this text is still relevant today. Professor James Tobin, the Nobel Prize winner in economics and famous among activists for his Tobin tax proposals, has also given the book much praise. It's very sad that such books are not widely available nor incorporated into the core school curricula so that the monetary system could be clearly identified for what it really is. It's Mr. Bernstein himself who sums up this dilemma over educating people about the monetary system so eloquently. He says in his book that when we, quote, ask what the American dollar is really based upon, we would have to say that it exists essentially on promises and bookkeeping machines. If anyone were to set up such a system by decree or legislation, it would probably fail. Indeed, it is just as well that most people never stop to realize that the money they earn for their efforts is only a number in a bookkeeping machine, or a piece of paper convertible into nothing more than another number in a bookkeeping machine. End quote. The English word credit can be traced back to its Latin origins as being synonymous with belief, faith, confidence, and trust. While many bankers may be aware that this trust is not well founded once you get past the smoke and mirrors surrounding money or credit creation, it is certainly not in their best interest to advertise this fact. This is because the system works to their advantage. If public confidence in the monetary system is to be shaken, it will have to come from those hurt by the monetary system. But first, they themselves will have to get to the point of questioning the system they have placed their trust in. The growing abuses of credit creation powers over the poor and the growing awareness of these abuses that we will discuss in Wizards today and elsewhere in Wizards may very well act as a catalyst to get people to this realization. In this edition of Wizards, we're going to go and chat with some people at the American Association for Retired Persons, or AARP, who just gave some very informative testimony to the Senate Banking Committee about what some of the hungry banks have been up to lately. It seems that after the Asian financial crisis, the bank's appetite for foreign adventures was somewhat diminished for just a little while, and they had to look closer to home for those high return loans. The elderly must have been must have seemed something of an attractive target market for their high equity, which is mostly in the form of home equity, but low-income profiles. Such a demographic is a prime target for what is known as equity stripping. We will talk more about equity stripping when we go visit the AARP, but to draw some parallels with early editions of Wizards, this equity stripping is very similar to what happens in foreign investing, followed by IMF bailouts, that we have spoken about in early editions of Wizards. The big banks and financial players, mostly of course the ones too big to fail, whose loans start to default, but who cannot have the defaults hit their books in any great extent, need someone to get the money out from somewhere to prevent these defaults. That is when the IMF steps in with its bailout packages and austerity programs to squeeze the money out of the country that doesn't have any money, and by that I mean the so-called hard currency. The IMF completes its mission by equity stripping, which is selling off the real assets, the real physical assets of the country and labor as well, to generate cash to pay back the banks. In the domestic retail equity stripping examples we'll look at today, we'll see that this is very similar to what shady banks do directly to those easily preyed upon at home. We will also see that many of these shady operators are actually subsidiaries of the large, well-established banks like Citigroup, JP Morgan Chase, and Bank of America. Today's study of predatory lending will take us to one of the cities where abusive lending practices are some of the worst in the country, and to the state with one of the most bank-friendly foreclosure laws on the books. Interestingly, it is also the place where the Federal Trade Commission has recently filed suit against Citigroup for the predatory practices of its subsidiary, Associates First Capital, in what could become the largest and most public case against a predatory lender ever seen in this country. This location is Atlanta, Georgia.
One day we must come to see that the whole Jericho Road must be changed, so that men and women will not be constantly beaten and robbed as they make their journey on life's highway. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth with righteous indignation. It will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries, and say this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America and say this is not just. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just.
These are some words from Reverend King, given at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in 1967, during his speech about the Vietnam War, which 3 years later and after his death received a Grammy Award. We'll hear some more words from his speech that was given so close to the neighborhoods and the areas where predatory lending is so prevalent in Atlanta, but as we shall see, is actually rampant throughout the entire state of Georgia and seemingly throughout the nation. Before going further into the relationship between the Federal Reserve, the commercial banks, and the poor, let's just take a look at the so-called science behind the monetary system. The predatory behavior of banks is most pronounced, of course, where they're easy targets. The easy targets are the poor. And we're not just going to focus on the relationship between the commercial banks and the poor. As noted above, we're first going to look at the relationship between the father of the banks, the Federal Reserve, and the poor. And in order to do this, we'll look at some of the underlying principles or ideas that might be influencing the behavior of those that make money. The famous extreme capitalist and private property advocate Ayn Rand, or sometimes pronounced Ayn Rand, who we mentioned in the second edition of Wizards as the author of the book Atlas Shrugged, once said, quote, "If money is the root of all evil, then what is the root of all money?" End quote. And this might make you chuckle a bit if you recall that Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, worked with her extensively on her book Atlas Shrugged, released in 1957, which many right-wingers claim to be the most influential book since the Bible. In subsequent years, Greenspan also contributed to Rand's publication known as The Objectivist. Today, Rand's protege is right at the center of all money, and perhaps her question is answered. Since money has become the backbone of so much of our social fabric, and it is, after all is said and done, just based on faith and belief in it, we had better know something about the beliefs of those at the center of it. That Greenspan has a long history in the banking and finance sectors, including the obligatory stint at J.P. Morgan, is hardly surprising in the world of central bankers. What is perhaps more worthy of attention is his service to Rand in her work. This is evidence of his rigorous training in her philosophy, which is known as objectivism, and whose fundamental features seem to overlap extensively with today's so-called neoliberal economic policy. The philosophy of objectivism largely rejects the idea that capitalism and capitalists should have any social goals at all, and promotes the idea that all acts and intentions should be purely selfish. Not surprisingly, Rand's work was a huge hit with the powers that be in America at the time, hot on the heels of the McCarthy era. Her ideas are actually very different to Adam Smith's philosophy, but we're not going to go into that here. In coming up with her rather extreme but very influential theories, it appears that Miss Rand must have been skipping her physics lessons. If she had bothered to look into the revolutionary developments in physics that took place in the early 1900s in the form of quantum mechanics and special relativity, her philosophy may have hit some stumbling blocks. Both of these radical developments in physics shook the foundations of Western thought premised on objectivity, independence of objects, and the absolute nature of time and certainty. Gradually, this way of looking at the world, which has many parallels with Eastern religions, has replaced the old Newtonian mechanics of looking at the world in the study of physics and is seeping its way into other sciences such as chemistry and biology. A fabulous text on these developments in physics and their parallels with Eastern philosophy, and written very well for the layperson, is the book called The Tao of Physics by Dr. Fridtjof Capra and written in 1975. These days it seems that students of business and economics are also too busy to attend physics classes, and this is one of the problems with having isolated disciplines of study. Today it is the economists, business people and politicians who are the furthest behind in picking up on these turn-of-the-century revolutionary developments in science. The only thing they gleaned from this scientific revolution was the knowledge of how to make the atomic bomb and blow things up in a spectacular fashion. But what they could have learned is some pretty interesting flaws in their own field of economics. Not only are today's mainstream economic theories and philosophies like objectivism outdated by being based on the old Newtonian or classical worldview, but these same outdated views are reflected in our current monetary system. Nothing illustrates this better than having a disciple of Rand at the helm of the Federal Reserve. This digression into modern physics, while talking about the relationship between the Fed and the poor, may seem rather odd. Nevertheless, it brings home the point that money is a social and psychological phenomenon, and so the beliefs and so-called science adopted by those that create and control money must be scrutinized. In later editions of Wizards, we're going to explore further some of the foundations of contemporary mainstream economic theory that are challenged by the worldview shift brought about by modern physics that the economists have yet to pick up on. It is rather ironic that mainstream economics, claiming to be so scientifically based, completely ignores the developments in the most objective science of all. The emerging field of so-called ecological economics is doing a much better job of incorporating modern physics. We'll just note here that these changes in perspective, long incorporated into Eastern philosophy, force us to think about time differently, to always acknowledge the interconnectedness of everything, and to recognize ever-present uncertainty in everything. The private property markets of today do not operate in this fashion. Rather, they treat people and objects as independent economic units and discount the future as less important than the present. Furthermore, they have very limited mechanisms for coping with uncertainty.
Happens to be symptomatic of a deeper malady in the American spirit. In 1957, a sensitive American official overseas said that it seemed to him that our nation was on the wrong side of a world revolution, increasingly by choice or by accident. This is a role our nation has taken, the role of those who make peaceful revolutions impossible by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that comes from the immense profits of overseas investments. Now, I'm convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin to shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our present policies.
Let's move on to talk more specifically about the relationship between the Federal Reserve and the poor. Under the old world view, central bankers use more or less traditional techniques for exercising some control over the economy, and a large part of this is maintaining the confidence of the markets in the monetary system. So people that don't have much money don't factor into central bankers' decisions very much at all. On the surface, many might think that there is no relationship between the Federal Reserve and the poor to speak of. However, this ignores the interconnectedness of everything, and this is perhaps best considered within the context of the zero-sum game that we spoke about in Wizards Part 1. As income and wealth gaps have widened, fewer people have more and more money, and the majority of the people are getting less. Many of those that have accumulated lots of money go looking for lots of places to invest it or gamble with it so that it will make more. This has led to an explosion in non-bank financial institutions and the use of corporate bonds and other such instruments in lending. None of these mechanisms create money out of thin air because the players don't have a banking license. But because the players have accumulated so much of the existing money, they can become financiers themselves by lending out the piles of dough they've accumulated. Thus, according to Martin Meyer in the book The Fed, only 1/5 of commercial and industrial financing now comes from the banks. The rest comes from people and non-bank institutions that have accumulated lots of the existing money. This has several implications. First, the Fed's powers over the market is more limited because there are so many non-bank financiers, so that the Fed has to do whatever it can to please these non-bank markets and keep their confidence in the whole financial system alive. By necessity, this means always pleasing the people that already have lots of money. Second, banks go looking all over the place for new people and entities to lend to, since the domestic non-bank corporations have abandoned them pretty much. This search has been a big part of banks' overseas lending adventures and the phenomenal growth in lending to the subprime domestic markets over the past decade. The subprime market is people with bad credit histories, which correlates well with low income earners and low wealth groups. This loan market has grown 300% from about $75 billion in 1993 to over $300 billion by the year 2000, and this is according to the Wall Street Journal. Previously, the banks wouldn't touch this market with a 10-foot pole, but in their never-ending search for new borrowers, especially at high yields, this has become a huge growth area.